In 1983, a visionary and unconventionally wordless film became a sensation upon release. The film's title added an ancient word from the Hopi language to our cultural lexicon. It was named Koyaanisqatsi. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. Koyaanisqatsi was unlike any film many viewers had seen in 1983 or since. Powerful, moving, transcendent, it depicted a world out of balance. Its time-lapse and slow-motion visions by photographer Ron Fricke and musical compositions by Philip Glass induced a trance state in some, a perfect partnership of sound and vision. The film was the result of a collaboration between its director, Godfrey Reggio, and a host of fine artists, driven by an almost spiritual quest to use cinema to create an urgent poetry. It was a message to a human civilization that was devouring itself. Celebrating Koyaanisqatsi's 30th anniversary of its theatrical release, I had the pleasure of speaking with Godfrey Reggio on the stage of the Plaza Theater before a late screening of the film on August 11, 2013. It would be one of the most memorable stage conversations I conducted over the last 6 years at the Plaza Classic Film Festival.
So this is a film that, frankly, I hadn't seen in probably 2 decades. I saw it certainly after it had just come out, as well as a few times through college. And watching it again a few months ago, it's amazing the impact of those images that were still in my mind. I could remember, as each one came up, it triggered these memories of seeing it decades before. And I want to set the stage a little for the audience, because in 1982, 83, when this came out, there had really not been anything quite like it. I think it's a groundbreaking film. It's pure cinema. It's sound, it's vision. And I'm just wondering, without any sort of context for that, were you influenced by certain filmmakers? Were you just driven by an idea and grappling with how to visualize it?
Very good question. For the longest time, I felt I was mentally ill. And please, with all respect, because I had worked for a long time with juvenile delinquents as a street organizer when I was a brother, a Christian brother. In fact, I used to come to El Paso on the south side. I'd bring our street gang. He had a fight with local street gangs. It was quite a memorable time for me, so I want to thank El Paso for that. But let me try to be responsive to your question. During the time I was working with gangs, I had the opportunity to see a film by Luis Buñuel called Los Olvidados, The Forgotten Ones, The Young and the Damned. It was the first film he made in Mexico after being thrown out of Franco's Spain. And when it was made in the late 40s, at the opening night, all the notables, the left community, the artistic community, people booed, stood up, were leaving, were outraged by the film because they felt that he had in some way hurt the reputation of Mexico because he talked about juvenile delinquents. That film went immediately to Cannes, and it won the prize in Cannes. And, of course, it came back to Mexico City, and everyone celebrated it. That's the way kind of things happen. I didn't know that at the time. When I saw that film, being a monk, you don't see many movies. That film was not entertainment. It was not information. It was not knowledge. It was like a spiritual experience for me and the young people that I worked with. It touched our soul. In fact, I immediately went out and bought a 16-millimeter copy of that film, somewhere in Austin, actually, and used it as a way to organize with the street gangs. So it was my entrance. I felt that if I could be so moved in cinema the way that Buñuel moved me, that maybe I could try that a bit. At that time in my life, it was clear to me that, you know, if you tell a person, excuse my English here, that they're a shit, they'll probably be one. But if you tell someone that they're great, 9 out of 8 of us, if you shadow that with some love and attention and devotion, will rise to that occasion. And it was my feeling that while these were delinquent kids, that it was the society, really, that was delinquent. And how do you wrap your head around that? And I felt, literally, that cinema, we all you know, we're still telling stories in front of the electronic fireplace now, or the fire campfire. And it's something that we're all irrevocably connected to, the moving image. It's become like the new church for many people. So I felt that if I wanted to put some of my feelings into something, that cinema would be the direction to go.
The form that that took, though, there wasn't a lot before you. I mean, this is a revolutionary film in many ways. It's groundbreaking. I mean, how did you arrive at visualizing just what form your passion would spill out into the cinema?
Well, fortunately for me, I did not go to film school. For those of you that are as old as I am, you probably learned typing. So when you learn FDS, well, all those numbers, if you had to learn a completely different way of typing, it would be having to unlearn what you learned. So had I gone to film school, I would have perhaps been making a different kind of film. But because I was naive, because I was following my muse, as it were, I felt that I could do this. In effect, I acted as if I knew what I was doing. Now, let's talk about the form of the film. It's my point of view that all of us see the world through language. We might think it's our eyes that let us see the world, but it's the language that we speak that allows us to see the world. In the beginning of the 20th century, there were arguably 40,000 languages and principal dialects on the planet. Today, there are less than 4,000 principal languages and dialects on the planet. At that time, in the beginning of the 20th century, there was 1.7 billion people on the planet. Today, there are 7-plus billion people on the planet. So there's a curious inverse relationship. You would think that the more people we had, the more languages we would have. But what's happening is the world is being homogenized into one world, one place, one people, one idea. Now, that's a point of view, I realize, but I'm going to lay it on you or inflict you with it. So my point of view is that the world we live in, the languages that we possess no longer describe the world in which we live in, because we no longer live in a natural or in a humanistic world. We live in a technological universe, a world of zeros and ones, a world where technology, anything you could have said about the divines in the past, probably you can say about technology now, that the world is being made anew in the image and likeness of technology. And what that means is enormous homogenization. That the beauty of life for me is its diversity. If we had one language, one weather pattern, one way of doing things, it would become very boring very fast. The beauty of life is that it's held together through diversity, that unity is created through diversity. And the motto, as it were, of the world that I'm talking about right now is divided we stand, which is not a very popular idea. The world we inhabit now, its shibboleth or its motto is united we stand. And the world is being homogenized in this globalized moment in which we live. And for me, this is an unspeakable tragedy. So to make a film and try to use the language that we speak to explain it, I didn't want to explain anything. Not that that's unimportant, it's very important. I didn't want to give information, nor did I wish to tell a traditional story. I wanted to offer through this medium, through this mediated experience, an experience, albeit limited, of the world in which we live. Something that, where you give up specific meaning in order to create perhaps a meaningful experience for the viewer. Let me use an example. If you went out to the mountain here at sunset with your sweetheart, you wouldn't turn to him or to her and say, gee, I wonder what the sunset meant tonight. Sunset doesn't mean anything. However, it can be immensely meaningful. So what I'm looking for in this kind of cinema is something that is meaningful. These films are deliberately designed to be incomplete. The answer is in you. So really, these films face you, and if there are, a handful of people in here tonight, if those, at the end of the film, all of you could have had a vastly different experience because, like art, it speaks specifically to the person that observes it. If art had one message, it would be like Coca-Cola or propaganda. And art, the beauty of art is that it has no intrinsic meaning. Its basic meaning is its mystery, and it has a free offering to those that see it or experience it, and it's going to hopefully speak differently to each person.
But I think also that the film is an immense leap of faith, because what you just said is you're trusting that there are people watching this that can still make it a meaningful experience for them.
Well, you know, obviously these aren't mass man films. What I mean by that, these aren't blockbuster films. They're not things that are accessible to everyone. But I'm of the point of view, even if it was the right thing, if all of us did it, it would be the wrong thing. So these are, I don't want to call them niche films, but they're certainly not for everybody. They're for those that can bear the infliction of having to come in here and say, gee whiz, I wonder what the story is.
So can you be inflicted with beautiful images and beautiful sound and beautiful ideas?
Indeed, because art is about infliction. It's about putting an impression on somebody. It's trying to watermark those that come in contact with the art. So it's in that sense, it is an infliction. But when you come to a regular movie, you come with an expectation. You come with the expectation of a story, characterization, plot, something that you can put your mind around, or something that entertains you, that is scrutable, that you understand. This is not aimed at your head. It's aimed at your solar plexus. It's aimed at a different sense within you. The point of view of these films is that the quieter a human being can become, the more sensitive they become to the outside world. So these films turn off your mind, leave your expectation at the door. In a regular film, you have the foreground of characterization and plot, and you have the background, which in cinematic terms is called second unit production. It's just to put you in the context of the room, the city, the location, etc. In these films, we take out all of the foreground of cinema, the characterization and plot, and we take the background, that which is hidden in plain sight. We take things like traffic, like buildings, and make them as if they're Rita Hayworth. In other words, shoot those objects as if they're subjects. Shoot them in an animated way so that they take on a voice of their own.
You've been listening to part one of my conversation with director Godfrey Reggio, recorded live on the stage of the Plaza Theater before a screening of his iconic 1983 film, Koyaanisqatsi. Just in time for the 30th anniversary of the theatrical release of the film, Koyaanisqatsi, along with its two kindred sequels, has been restored and released by the Criterion Collection on DVD and Blu-ray. Join me next week as we conclude my conversation with filmmaker and thinker Godfrey Reggio. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.